And we conclude today's program by marking the return of the woman nicknamed The Voice.
I hope life treats you kind.
Whitney Houston is not only one of the best-selling artists in the world, she's a pop music icon with hits such as Saving All My Love for You, I Want to Dance with Somebody, and this song, I Will Always Love You. Now, Whitney Houston is back with a long-anticipated CD titled I Look to You that hit stores yesterday. And here to review Whitney Houston's latest work is Steve Jones, a music critic for USA Today. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Before we jump into this interview, let's hear some of Whitney's new music. What songs stand out for you on this album?
Her current hit right now is Million Dollar Bill, which was written by Alicia Keys and produced by Swiss Beatz. And I think the idea was to kind of bring her back with a contemporary, kind of mid-tempo song that would probably get her into some newer fans as well as her older fans who I think will support her no matter what she does.
Came in the door, checked in my coat, and who I'm looking for is staring in my face. Oh, they played our song, we hit the floor, he held me strong, and we danced the night away. Oh,
how did she come to collaborate with Alicia Keys?
Well, you know, this whole comeback has been orchestrated by Clive Davis, who was her mentor in the beginning.
Clive Davis, the legendary music producer.
Yes. And he has, for about a year now, been really gathering songwriters and producers, trying to create the perfect scenario for her to come back.
How does this latest CD of Whitney Houston's compare to the classic music that we're long accustomed to?
I think that she is trying to get back to that sound, but at the same time, this is a singer who has not been around very much for the last 6 years, and really, her last really great album was 10 years ago. So this is kind of a cautious relaunch of her career, I think.
Steve, you've described the album as cautious, doesn't take a lot of risks, I assume. Does one really want to try to relaunch a singing career by releasing music that could be considered tepid?
I don't think that she could go in the direction of trying to sound too young, because that may have alienated some of her older fans. But I think right now what she has to do is reestablish herself just as an artist. You have to remember, she's coming from a pretty deep hole. She hasn't fed her fans for a very long time, and a whole generation of other fans have come up who basically only know her from her trials and tribulations. And, you know, it really kind of short-circuited what was a really impressive career.
In appealing to some of her old fans, which of these songs do you think might stand out most for them?
I think that I Didn't Know My Own Strength is kind of one of those power ballads that she used to be known for.
I didn't know my own strength, and I crashed down. Tumble, but I did not crumble. I got through all the pain. I didn't know my own strength.
Whitney Houston's drawn years of attention for self-destructive behavior, drug abuse, alcoholism, friction, and finally divorce from her husband, Bobby Brown. Now, she doesn't reference him on the album, but she sure does seem to allude to relationship trouble, at least with one of the songs written by R. Kelly, Salute. Let's hear a bit of that.
You say you wanna walk away, you ain't got nothing to say. I salute you, yeah. Go on out the door now, you take care. No more tears to shed. What you expected me to beg? Well, I'm not, I'm done. So when you leave, just close the door behind you, 'cause I'm feeling kind of tall.
So what's Whitney Houston trying to say to us as listeners with this song, Salute?
I think as listeners, she's trying to say that she's been through all sorts of trauma and that she is ready to move on. One of the things that struck me about listening to the whole album was that she didn't really go into a whole lot of recriminations or looking for pity. She's just kind of saying, I went through a lot. Some of it was my fault, and I'm moving on.
Steve Jones, what happens if Whitney Houston's CD flops?
They'll have to go back to the drawing board. you know, she has a history of taking a long time between CDs. After she did The Bodyguard, there was a long time between albums. She did The Preacher's Wife, and there was another long gap before the next album. I really don't think that she can afford to do that again if she really wants to be viable. This album was released on a kind of an odd day just so it could make the Grammy nomination deadline. And I think that what they're hoping is she will be able to get a lot of Grammy nominations that will kind of boost her profile.
How did Whitney's latest effort strike you, Steve Jones?
I think it was good when you consider she's a 46-year-old singer who hasn't been singing a whole lot, and she's not yet old enough to just fall into that aging diva role that, say, an Aretha Franklin could. But at the same time, she's kind of past the ingenue stage, which was what she was when she first came around.
Are there any songs that you liked particularly on this album?
Well, Salute was one of my favorite ones. I also kind of like the treatment she did with A Song for You. That's the Leon Russell song, and that's the only cover on the album. Normally that's done as a very poignant ballad, and she kind of gave it a up-tempo treatment.
Steve Jones is a music critic for USA Today, and he joined us from his office in McLean, Virginia. Steve, thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
We're alone now, and I'm singing a song too.
And that's our program for today. I'm Korva Coleman, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
This month, Jay Leno starts his highly anticipated new gig as host of a 10 o'clock show on NBC. Of course, Leno's most well-known for being the king of late night as host of The Tonight Show. But this morning, we're going to take a look back at the time and place where Leno and many other big-name comedians got their start. Los Angeles in the 1970s.
I'm originally from the East. I've been living out here about 4 months. You know, I can't get used to living out here. I don't know how many of you are from New York. The beach is on the wrong side.
That was Leno with black hair and a plaid shirt, same big chin, right after he arrived in L.A. so poor that the police picked him up, thinking he was homeless. Another young comedian came to L.A. a few months later from Indiana. His name was David Letterman.
I just got back from Reno, stayed at a condominium up there, and really a cheap condominium. Had one of those whirlpools. You know what a whirlpool jacuzzi is? I think it was a cheap jacuzzi, though, because when everybody got in the water, we had to take turns going...
Leno and Letterman were joined by Robin Williams, Andy Kaufman, Richard Lewis, and many other household names to be during what our guest calls stand-up comedy's golden era. Bill Nadelsieder was a reporter for the L.A. Times at the time. He was covering the burgeoning comedy scene, and his new book is called I'm Dying Up Here, Heartbreak and High Times in Stand-Up Comedy's Golden Era. Welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
Why do you call the stand-up comedy's golden era?
Well, in Los Angeles, people were arriving by the week from all around the country. You know, class clowns from all over the place just picked up and moved, invariably inspired by sitting there watching the Tonight Show and hearing Johnny Carson say, now here's a young comic who's appearing here in town at the Comedy Store. And boom, that was it. They heard that and they packed their bags and headed to L.A. thinking that if they just got on this stage at this place called the Comedy Store, well, they would be on Carson and they would be comedians. Before long, you had 300, young comics living in West Hollywood around the Comedy Store trying to get on that stage.
But Los Angeles was not always the hub for comedy. Early in your book, you talk about Johnny Carson moving The Tonight Show from New York to the West Coast.
Well, that was the most significant thing because Johnny Carson was the prime arbiter of what was funny in America for a very long time. If he thought you were funny and put you on his show, you had a career. If he didn't, you didn't have a career.
This world that you write about was so densely packed with talent. What impact did that tight-knit community have on the comedy that these guys were doing?
It was absolutely electric, and they would all share stuff, and they would write stuff down on napkins, and they'd be hanging out at the bar between sets. I mean, and, it's hard to imagine now, but that you on a random Friday night, you could see Letterman and Leno and Richard Lewis and Robin Williams and Elaine Boozler all on the same stage.
Will you read a passage from the book that kind of captures a bit of that sense? This is on page 106.
Ringo Starr made a memorable solo appearance at Sunset one night, arriving so intoxicated that Mike Binder, who was working the door, had to help him to a seat and back. Starr was seated just as David Letterman took the stage, and the former Beatle immediately began heckling him, which attracted the attention of every comic with an earshot. Letterman had a reputation for eviscerating hecklers, and as word spread along the back hallway, other comics started filing into the room to watch the impending bloodshed. It wasn't a fair fight. In the spotlight, Letterman couldn't see who the heckler was, so he showed no mercy, and Starr was too drunk to appreciate how badly Letterman was beating him up. Finally, one of the comics took pity and called out, "Hey, Dave, it's Ringo." "Oh, that makes sense," Letterman shot back in the direction of Starr. "You ruined your career, and now you've come here to ruin mine." George Miller almost fell off his stool laughing.
Were you there that night?
No, I was not. I was there on other nights, but not that one.
In the center of this book, you have a collection of photographs, and there's one that I just have to ask you about. It shows Andy Kaufman posturing in a full-length robe that looks like it could be made out of silk. The caption on the photo says, "Andy Kaufman getting ready to wrestle on the author's patio, November 1978.
Okay.
What's the story?
All right. I was set to do a profile on Andy for the LA Times. And we had the interview set up for a couple of days ahead. And one night around 7 or 8 o'clock, my phone rang. And, "Hi, it's Andy. Can I come over?" And I was sort of taking it back. "Well, sure. Come on over." And about a half an hour later, Andy Kaufman showed up at my front door, and he had a cardboard vaudevillian suitcase with him. And he insisted on performing his entire act in pantomime while I took pictures, complete with three costume changes.
An audience of one.
Myself and my wife, who was 8 months pregnant at the time. And he wanted to wrestle her. And that was
No.
But there is a funny picture of him, you know, staring her down like he was going to wrestle her.
So many of the people you write about in this book died before their time. Is it difficult to see the immense talent that is no longer with us?
Yeah. Well, that sort of happened with that generation in comedy and rock and roll. I think there was probably more drugs in the rock and roll arena.
You write about all-night cocaine sessions with the comedians.
Yep, that did happen. But it wasn't part of the comedy lifestyle. There were some who did that. There were a lot of them who didn't. I mean, you know, Jay Leno was an absolute straight arrow. Letterman, they didn't do that. And, you know, comics didn't make enough money to buy cocaine. You know, they were lucky to buy pot.
Robin Williams had the line that cocaine is God's way of telling you you're making too much money.
A very true statement.
Well, you know, we're having this conversation on the eve of Jay Leno's new show. It would seem appropriate to go out with a clip of his first ever appearance on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
One, yeah.
See, my folks grew up during the Depression. So consequently, they make you feel very guilty about everything, you know? I mean, even now I go home for a weekend. "Hey, Dad, pass the salt."
"We never had salt when we were kids. We had to live without salt. We didn't have underwear or potatoes. We ate dirt every day of the week. Your mother and I hunted wild dog for food. We had nothing when we were your age."
Bill Nadelsider, what do you think?
I remember that Jay Leno. He told me this. He said, you know, that he could sell a joke that really wasn't that funny because he had a lot of attitude and he could do it with his voice and all that. And Letterman didn't quite have that brio, so he had to write better jokes was the issue. They were sort of a mutual admiration society back then. In separate interviews, I asked each of them, "Okay, so, you know, whose act among your peers do you most admire?" And each of them instantly named the other.
Bill Nadelsider, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bill Nadelsider is the author of I'm Dying Up Here, Heartbreak and High Times in Stand-Up Comedy's Golden Era. And you'll find clips of Leno and Letterman's early performances in L.A., plus an excerpt of William Nadelsider's new book on our website, npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Renee Montagne.
I am about to utter two words that many of you will consider beneath this program, but they are two words that many of you will probably utter this week. Ready? Levi Johnston. The ex of Sarah Palin's daughter and the father of Palin's grandson, Tripp, has given an interview to Vanity Fair in which he is critical of the former Alaska governor and Republican candidate for vice president. At 19, Johnston has now been on Larry King, The Today Show, The Early Show. He even appeared on The Tyra Banks Show with his sister and their mother, who just pled guilty to dealing OxyContin. On that show, Banks took embarrassment to previously unplumbed depths.
"So I have to ask you a personal question, but you're on my Tyra couch and there are no personal questions. Were you practicing safe sex?"
"Yeah."
Even when the baby was conceived?
We were.
And so there were just wardrobe malfunctions?
I guess.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How's all this playing in Alaska? And who's running the media campaign for this teenage hockey-playing high school dropout from Wasilla? Well, joining us is Brendan Joel Kelly of the Anchorage Press. That's an alternative weekly. Brendan Joel Kelly, who is the coaching staff of Team Levi here?
The coaching staff is actually his mother's attorney, Rex Butler, who defended her in the OxyContin case, and then a private investigator who works alongside Rex named Tank Jones.
And they're guiding Levi Johnston through this national media campaign?
Yeah, they've sort of switched their roles from that of defense attorney and private investigator into, you know, agents as CAA and are basically marketing the young man.
You interviewed Levi Johnston.
I did, about 4 or 5 weeks ago. It was in Rex Butler's office alongside Tank Jones. When I asked Levi a question, his eyes would dart to one or the other of them to make sure that he could answer such questions.
What did people in Alaska make of all this as Levi Johnston has become, I gather, one of the more prominent Alaskans in mass media this year?
It's unfortunate. We would really like to shed this tabloid image, Robert.
Vanity Fair is not going to let you for a while.
No.
In the article, he talks about Sarah Palin. Self-described hockey mom says she didn't show up at too many hockey games.
He does indeed say that. And I've seen some things coming out today that show some contradictions between what Levi said previously and what he's saying in the Vanity Fair article about the adoption thing, which is really the bombshell out of the excerpts that have been released, that Sarah had encouraged Bristol and Levi to keep the pregnancy a secret and that she and Todd would adopt the baby. But he had told CNN's Larry King that adoption was never considered, abortion was never considered.
And his relationship to Rex Butler, which has two dimensions, Rex Butler represented his mother pro bono?
That's my understanding, yeah.
But their work for Levi Johnston is not pro bono.
It's my understanding that they would get some sort of cut of whatever income he's going to take in if he gets a reality show, if he gets movie roles, with some of the things that they've talked about.
I don't know what's required for one to make a career of a reality show, but was your impression of him from the interview that he has some talent? He's an interesting young man?
He's a fairly interesting young man. The sort of reality shows that he was talking about, he told me that he'd been approached with Who Wants to Date Levi Johnston, where they'd send 30 beautiful girls up here, and he would take them hunting and fishing. And his response to me was, I can't handle one girl, much less 30. So I think he's sort of aiming to stay away from the more tabloidy versions of reality shows, but do something more Alaskan.
Well, Brendan Joel Kelly, thanks a lot for talking with
Thank
us.
Thank you.
That's Brendan Joel Kelly, who's associate editor of the Anchorage Press, which is an alternative weekly in Alaska.
Michael Jackson died more than 2 months ago, but he still has not been buried. There have been multiple autopsies, then came public and private memorials. Finally, this week, come the funeral and burial. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports now on the legendary cemetery where Jackson will be laid to rest.
Michael Jackson's family and friends gave him a very public farewell in July at a televised memorial in downtown Los Angeles. No one outside the family was sure where the singer's body went after that, but now it's clear where it's going, to Forest Lawn in Glendale, the original celebrity cemetery.
Smile, though your heart is aching.
Yes, that's Nat King Cole. Forest Lawn is his final resting place. It's also true for Clark Gable and Carole Lombard, W.C. Fields, and Humphrey Bogart.
I gotta be me.
Sammy Davis Jr. is in a private garden crypt shaded by 100-year-old oak trees. It's one of the spots where you need a special key to open tall bronze gates. Privacy is one of the reasons the Jackson family chose Forest Lawn. The cemetery's spokesman, William Martin, is so circumspect he doesn't even admit famous people are buried here.
It's Forest Lawn policy not to publicize people that have come to us. It's something that we choose not to do out of respect for the privacy of the families.
But much of the world already seems to know that Michael Jackson's coming here. Is Forest Lawn worried about what that might mean?
I get asked that question a lot. Many families call up and are concerned that Forest Lawn will change and become something they didn't come to us for when they came to us initially.
What they came for is peace and privacy, something that Martin says won't change even after Michael Jackson is here. The cemetery will remain open for the public to enjoy, to wander down its shaded pathways, and to admire the reproduction masterpieces scattered throughout the grounds and buildings. Forest Lawn's lavish surroundings have inspired satires, sometimes acerbic ones, such as writer Evelyn Waugh's, and more gentle ones, like singer John Denver's.
I want to go simply when I go. They'll give me a simple funeral there, I know. With a casket lined in fleece and fireworks spelling out rest in peace. Oh, take me when I'm gone to Forest Lawn.
Since it was created in 1906, Forest Lawn has been something most cemeteries are not, a tourist attraction. Bill Martin says the art, reproducing some of the world's great works, is the reason.
I'm a commoner in L.A. Where do I see this kind of stuff? This is really, honestly, the vision of our founder.
But there's no denying the allure of Forest Lawn's star-studded census of permanent residents. A whole culture exists where people visit the graves, partly in homage, partly as history detectives. Steve Goldstein wrote L.A.'s Graveside Companion, and he says Forest Lawn is so popular.
It's often called Disneyland of the Dead.
His colleague Lisa Burks writes the blog gravehunting.com and says this is the perfect place for Michael Jackson and his family.
You can't do better than Forest Lawn if you want to have a secure, private place. And I think Catherine and the kids need to have that. And so in that instance, I'm very glad that he's here, and I hope that he gets to stay here for as long as she needs him to be here.
With its beautiful things and great performers, Forest Lawn could provide Michael Jackson in death something he rarely found in life, a place to fit in. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.